The following teaching is part two of a 33-part study of the Book of Colossians by Dr. Ken Boa.
2 weeks ago, we began a study of the Book of Colossians, and I just gave you some introductory materials along that line. And I just want to finish giving you an overview of some of the key themes in this book and why it's so incredibly important, and particularly in our time, to know this book, to study it, and to read, mark, and inwardly digest the resources in this book. So, Colossians, I said before, is the most Christ-centered book in the entire Bible. You see more about Jesus in this book, about who he is, and about what he has accomplished in terms of the density of verses concerning him, the elevation. It's called a high Christology, which means a view of Christ. And so we're going to be looking at that. And in the context of this book, we realize from the internal evidence that Paul was addressing a heresy that was growing in that part of the world, in Greece. And this heresy seemed to be a syncretistic kind of religion. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Syncretism is when you combine bits and pieces from this religion here or that deal there and put them together, which is exactly where people are in our culture. Some of you know I'm going to be doing a 10-point comparison between the United States and Rome. I think it's going to be before its fall, Rome and Greece before their fall. It'll be just be, I think it's December 4th, the first Monday. And in doing that, I have become impressed with what I believe is the fact that our civilization is more like those and just before their demise than anything in between. We are really at a point. In fact, I believe that we are overripe for our demise. And there's nothing to suppose that Western civilization will escape the demise that other civilizations have gone through. Arnold Toynbee listed 21 civilizations, 14 of which have now crumbled. They no longer exist. What's to make us suppose that we will be the exception? Civilizations go through their birth, their growth, their decay, and then their death. And that at the end of the day, one of the things that causes the death of a civilization is the loss of a moral consensus, the loss of a spiritual absolute, and so forth. And what was going on here was a syncretistic religion. It sounds a good deal like what people are getting into with the Gnostic Gospels, particularly when people are reading the Da Vinci Code and so forth. They are believing the lies that the Gnostic Gospels give us the real truth about Jesus, and that the canonical Gospels, namely Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were giving us a kind of revised view, more patriarchal and so forth, and that the real skinny can be found in these other Gospels. Actually, tonight I'm going to be doing a special presentation, if you're interested, on unraveling the Da Vinci Code. It'll be right upstairs at 7 o'clock. But this is such an important issue. What I'm trying to do is leverage that bad book for good. It's an enjoyable read, but it's a bad book. And because people in our time are so dumb that they actually believe it's true. Oh, gee, I always thought that was true. Now I know. You know, they read a stupid novel and they think now this is actually true. That Jesus is not the Son of God, that he was married to Mary Magdalene and this, that, and the other. That the original church suppressed the Gospels, the real Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels. Friends, those Gnostic Gospels didn't exist for over 100 years after the canonical Gospels. You can't suppress what doesn't exist. It's just amazing, this call revisionism. And some fringe scholar comes up with something, and then people just follow the bandwagon. We are in that kind of time that very much like the people in Corinth. They were combining elements from Greek speculation, Oriental mysticism, and Jewish legalism. Very bizarre combination, that. So they were pulling things from various threads, and especially in chapter 2, you can see, though, that it involved a very low view of the body and probably of nature as a whole, which, by the way, is indeed part of the whole perspective of Gnosticism, that the spirit is good, the physical, the visible is not. You see the idea there, so that it's not a creation-oriented approach. It seems to me that the natural trend of people from the very beginning, in the rebellion against the true knowledge of God that they have in Romans chapter 1, which makes it very clear we have that knowledge, is to move away from a God that transcendent and distinct from his universe to a God or gods that are part of the universe that are not sometimes, in fact, in liberal seminaries, this is what you get, the idea of panentheism, gods and everything and so forth. And the idea here is by doing that, you try to eliminate the distinction between ourselves and him and make God one with the universe, and you have this mystical notion. So there's a good deal of mysticism and Oriental speculation going on here. And my view is this, that any attempt, and Paul's view was this, any attempt to fit Christ into that kind of a system would undermine his person and redemptive work. At the point where you want to say that Jesus is just one of many, you've just undermined his uniqueness. I hate it when I see a list, and the list has, for example, it might have Buddha and Zoroaster and Socrates and Plato and Jesus and Moses, and they threw him in there as if he's just one of many. You see the idea? Have you ever seen those kinds of lists? I find them loathsome because they are already telling us that he's just another inspired teacher, just a great philosopher. He will brook no rival. Either it is him or them, but you can't have it both ways. The biblical perspective is, and that's why it's regarded as, and your experience was that way, it's regarded as, well, frankly, it's regarded as bigoted. It's regarded by the world as being narrow-minded. It's regarded as being intolerant.
Medieval.
Retrograde. Yeah, they'll use certain terms like medieval and retrograde. You're just going back into the past. The fact will be that Christianity will always be against and contrary to the culture in which you live. When I was speaking at Whitfield Academy for their graduation ceremony last May, I used the text about the men of Issachar in 1 Chronicles 12:38, I think it is. The men of Issachar understood the times and knew what they had to do. I thought that was a very perceptive verse because it says two things. First of all, they understood their time. And by that, I said they knew their time. So I applied it to knowing your culture. And secondly, understood what they have to do. That's knowing your calling. It's important for you and me to know our culture and know our calling so that we can embed our calling in our culture. But if you don't know where your culture is going and what's happening here, you can easily be seduced and more a child of your culture than you might suppose because it's infusing itself upon us. To be frank with you, I find the siren call of all these voices to becoming increasingly anti-Christian and to become increasingly intolerant of what they define as intolerant. Did you catch that? The fact is that the most intolerant people on the planet now are in the universities because they are utterly intolerant of people that they think are intolerant. So they defeat themselves because, I will give you another example. We were talking about the intelligent design movement. Many in the scientific community are absolutely furious that Stephen Meyer managed to publish an article, I think it was Nature or Science, one of the most respected scientific journals, because they then realized afterwards that, oh, he was an intelligent design theorist, which means, of course, he must be a creationist and all that. So they were very angry that it got by the referees. Did you catch that? If you embrace the idea that design is a credible scientific option, are hammered out of court, you can't get published. The referees will keep you from being published no matter how good your work really is. And I find that to be astoundingly limited and astoundingly censorious because now we don't have a fair marketplace of ideas. You don't have an even playing field. People are just drummed out of court. And if you go to a university class, and if you share your perspective in a reasonable way that you believe really that Christ is who he claimed to be and that he's unique in all the world, you'll be drummed out of that deal. So we live in a culture in which more and more people are being seduced into the notion that everything goes and your truth can be your truth and mine can be mine and I'm glad it makes you happy. You all heard that, you know, true for you, not for me. But again, you've heard me say one of the refutations, and this is relevant to this book, is that people live as if ultimate reality is there. And if things that really are right and things are wrong, things are true and things are false, things are beautiful, things are ugly. We all live that way, even though our philosophies might belie us. Remember, I used the analogy of, it must have been several weeks ago. Remember a couple months ago, the Duke University students? Remember that, where they, I'll just refresh your mind on that, where the story goes that they went off to, went off on a weekend and they got back late for the test that was supposed to be on Monday morning. And their excuse that they offered to the professor was that their tire, one of the wheels blew out in their tire, remember, in their car, remember this? And that they didn't have a spare tire, and it was in the middle of the night, and so it caused them to be delayed in their return. So they asked if they could take the test the following morning. And he agreed, and the following morning, he put them in separate rooms, the two students. And there were two questions on the test, and the first one was worth 95%, and the second one was worth 5%. The first question only had two words and said, which tire? You catch that? You can't say that's true for you, but not for me. You see the point? In this world, we live as if things are true and false. Again, my simple example is you've overdrawn your account. You say, wait a minute, I had $30,000 in my account. The banker says, no, you had $3,000. That's true for you, but not for me. Would you really be able to get away with that in this world? Only in the world of la-la land, when you get into philosophy, do you become that total loss of common sense. You have to be educated to that level of imbecility. It doesn't come naturally. A little kid knows better. But people are embracing what C.S. Lewis calls boys' philosophies, things that a kid would know better. Anyway, I'm going off on a tirade, but the tirade is the kind of thing Paul really also wanted to correct. But here's the way you correct that falsehood. Yes, you need to understand what the teachings are. You need to understand your culture. But you also need to understand that the best way to refute an error is by focusing on truth, not just refuting the error. You see where I'm going with that? And Paul's stratagem is this way. What he does to refute their error is to give us an elevated portrait of Jesus Christ. And in doing that, he says, this is the true article. And the better you know him, the more clearly you can see the flaw, the deficiency in these false teachings. My own view is that anybody who is ignorant of Scripture is going to be more vulnerable to the kinds of things that people are bantering about. The better you know the Scriptures, the less vulnerable you will be to every wind of doctrine. In fact, Paul put it that way, that his desire is that you grow into maturity, and that therefore you will be deeply rooted and planted in Christ. You'll know the truth so well that you can discern a falsehood when you see it. I read a book, and I know I may have told you this. I never know where I say what, but that's all right. But the book years ago I read was Embraced by the Light, and this book was given to me, and I didn't know a thing about the book, but I took it, and this person was raving about how wonderful it was and how spiritual it was. Whenever they use the word spiritual, I begin to wonder right away, because that word can mean anything, you know. Native American spirituality, it can be tantric Buddhism. The fact is, though, that I started the book, and the first chapter wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. The second chapter said, whoa, and then they were slipping into it. And of course, that's the way these books work. They ease their way into it. For example, a Mormon, when he comes to your door, won't say, hey, we're polytheists. No, they'll say, we believe the Trinity. You see, they have these 10 points to give you on a card, and it all sounds good. If you press them, you discover that they don't believe anything that historic Christianity embraces. But they don't want you to say that. They want you to get in, and it kind of sucks you. So books do that as well. And I got more and more into it. I realized, wait a minute, this is the most bizarre combination. It sounds like she's a Mormon, but it sounds like she's a New Ager. And it turns out she was. She was a New Age Mormon, which is a real weird, I later read about. And it by the second chapter. But the thing is this, how did I know that? No one told me about what to expect in the book. The way you know it is by knowing the real thing. So if you want to know how to recognize counterfeit money, you study the real article. You don't study counterfeit money. You study the real money until you know it so well that something immediately strikes you as wrong, because there's so many ways in which you could counterfeit money, you couldn't learn them all. Similarly, there are so many cults, so many religions, so many kinds of options in this world, you couldn't know them all. But you can know the one thing, the genuine article. And the better you know Christ, the better you know the one who is the way, the truth, and the life, and the better you can then discern truth and error. The spirit of truth and the spirit of error is what we need to embrace. As John describes it, that we have the spirit of truth and the spirit of error, 1 John. So having said that, then, what Paul does is he gives some reasons for writing this book in order to encourage the readers to become, as he says in 1:23, he says, if you continue in the faith firmly established and steadfast, not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, of which I, Paul, was made a ministry. I want you to be firmly established. I want you to be deeply rooted. I want you to be steadfast, because the deeper you sink your roots, the less shallow you will be, the greater depth you have. My own view is that we are called to be people who have a depth about us that transcends the shallow culture in which we live, because let's be honest about it. This is a slick and shallow culture. There's no depth to it. And we don't want to be living on the surface of life. I think we're called to be contemplatives in action. Do you know what I mean by that? To be a contemplative is a person who sinks his roots deeply into the taproot of Christ, of who he is, of coming to know him, of meditating on the truth. But in action means you take that reality and you apply it in your world, in the world in which God's placed you. Again, you know your culture, you know your calling, and you embed your calling in the culture in which God has placed you. And that culture includes your arena of influence that God has sovereignly given you. So my own view then is that we are called then to be people who manifest this and whose roots are so deeply sunk that we will grow and bear fruit in the knowledge of Christ. That as you sink the roots deeply, so that the roots go down, the fruit is then on the other side is borne upward. And so that life then is manifested. The life beneath the soil is manifested above the soil as fruit. And we bear this fruit. Remember the analogy? We are called branches and Christ is the vine. I've identified 8 levels of intimacy in the scriptures about our relationship with God. I will not tell you about that right now. You'll see it another time. But one of those metaphors is that of being the branches on a vine. It's from the vegetable kingdom. There's metaphors from the animal kingdom and so forth. But this one is an interesting one because remember, what does a branch do? Does it create life? Yeah, what does a branch do? Does it create life?
Transports life.
That's exactly right. A branch does not create life. It receives life and transports it. What's the product of that life that it receives and manifests? It's called fruit. Well, you know, the sap is the life, really. The sap is what the vitality is. Rodney Dangerfield, you know, I looked at my family tree and I found out I was the sap. But,
he's going to be missed.
He will be missed.
Or he's bound to make a place.
Yeah. The overabundance of fruit, does the branch need the fruit to survive? Does not. The branch does not need the fruit. The fruit is the excess of life that the branch produces, that is produced through the branch. You see the idea? And that excess or the abundance of life, I've called you to bear fruit and that your fruit would be abundant. You see that idea? And I like to think of fruit in these two ways, that first of all, fruit has the quality of nourishing others. And secondly, it has the quality of reproduction because it carries the seeds of its own reproduction. By the way, that's edification and evangelism. Do you see? That's the Great Commission. It's the Great Commission and Commandment. It nourishes, but it also reproduces. We're called to grow and to reproduce. And the more you sink your roots into the soil of Christ and His love, the greater depth you have so that the more fruit you will bear. You see? You don't create life. You receive the life of Christ and manifest it. And it becomes His fruit born through you. You understand the difference? And parenthetically, I say this a lot because it's so important. We have to hear it many times. Stop trying to do things for Jesus. Don't try to do things for Jesus. In fact, instead, invite Him to do things through you. You catch the difference? It's enormous. Invite Him to manifest His life in you, through you, because it's not your life, it's His in you. Do you see that difference? It's not a semantic game. There's a very real difference in your perspective on that. So Paul is saying then that his desire is that they would grow and bear fruit, that they would have a deeper understanding and a firm adherence to the true gospel, and thus being able to oppose these resisting cultural and religious influences in their time. So that there are two things that he stresses in this book, the supremacy of Christ and secondly, submission to Christ. The supremacy of Christ is demonstrated in the first two chapters. Submission to Christ is manifested in the second two chapters. And of course, the supremacy of Christ tells you who and whose you are in Him, chapters 1 and 2. Submission to Christ tells you now what you are to do. Never put doing before being. Most sermons I've ever heard when I have gone to church in the past have always the vast majority have been doing. Do this, do that, do the other. You know, you ought to be a better this, you ought to be a better that, you ought to do that, you ought to go there, you ought to give that. You all know what I'm talking about. Do. They never talk about be. They never tell you about the source of power that makes it possible for you to do. I'm not against doing. That's the second two chapters of this book. But the first two chapters must never be ignored. You must not appeal for someone to do something until you tell them who and whose they are in Christ and what the source of power is for them to do that. Do you see the difference there? The reason why we stress the doing is because it's visible, measurable, and tangible. Whereas the being can't be quantified. Do you see? And men are uncomfortable with something that you can't measure, quantify, and see. Being, you can't measure, quantify, and see. It's relational. There are three theistic religions in the world, as you know, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Christianity differs from Judaism and Islam. Judaism is now practiced, not the Hebrew Bible. It's Pharisaic Judaism that eventually became the Talmudic Judaism. The Talmudic Judaism of today is not the practice of Israel in the past. You need to understand, because if you were doing that, you'd have to have a temple, you'd have to have a priesthood, you'd have to have sacrifices. There's no atonement apart from the shedding of blood, so that all changed. The point is this. They have an absolute monotheism, by which I mean that God has no partners. That would be the heresy of shirk, as they'd call it in Islam. That would be to ascribe a partner to Allah. He has no partners. Allah has no son, the Quran tells us again and again. In Judaism, the idea that Jesus, that Yeshua would actually be also Adonai, that he would be Yahweh, seems impossible to them. Because what they're saying is, you're a polytheist. What I find these two groups cannot seem to grasp is this, that in Christ's claims, Jesus did not claim that he was a man who became God. Rather, God came down to us and assumed humanity into himself. Do you see the difference? It's profound. Being the God-man, he was not lessened or diminished in his deity or in his humanity. It made it possible for us then to have an atonement. Now, I want to suggest that the biblical teaching is not a Trinitarian thought. Many people believe, many Muslims seem to believe, that the Trinity means that there are three gods, the Father, the Son, and Mary. Don't know where she came in there, but that's where many seem to believe. But the point is this. The idea of a unity and diversity, that God is a society, that there are three persons, but they're one being. Do you see the difference there? That is not three gods. It's far more profound than that. That God is a community of being. And because he's a community, he was not lonely. He was actually, in having more than one person, I stress this again and again, you cannot have love if there's one person. If Allah is one person, before he created the world, there was no thou. There was no other. Do you understand that idea? There was only Allah. And because of that, that's the ultimate form of narcissism. There's no I, thou. You cannot have love without an object to be loved. Would you agree with that idea? The same would be true in the view of, it's fascinating, the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber constantly talked about I and thou, but his actual Judaism didn't allow for an I and thou in the ultimate reality. It's a very interesting deal. We are relational beings. You need a thou in order for there to be love. Would you all agree with that? Only the Trinitarian teaching that the three persons are not each other, but they are God, provides the answer for how God can be one in many, how there can be a lover in the beloved, how there can be relationship, how there can be community. And therefore, God was not bored and lonely when he created the world. He didn't say, hey, I need somebody to talk to. Actually, he had perfect fellowship and community in himself. To be perfectly frank, God didn't need any of this. And I often say, I don't know why he created it. It's a lot more trouble than I think it'd be worth. The rebellion, the stupidity of humans. I'd want to, if I were God for a day, and see what people really are thinking, see what their real hearts are like, I'd thump them out of existence. Who needs this? I was fine myself. There's a deep mystery in why God's love will be manifested at great personal cost to bring us into communion with him, and a greater good will come out of the evil that we see in this planet. I find that the Trinitarian teaching is utterly unique. And the only foundation, in my view, ontological basis for true love, for true relationship, personhood, communication, submission, mutual service, all those are exemplified in the ultimate absolute, namely the Trinity. And therefore, we being created in his image are also people who are called to be lovers, people who are servants, people who are in communion and so forth. Does that make sense? This is a high worldview. There's nothing like this. In the marketplace of ideas, you're never going to find something that will correspond so beautifully to reality as biblical Christianity. I'm more and more persuaded as the years go by how it's the one thing that makes the most sense out of this world. The basic theme is this: you don't create the life, I create it, and I've called you to bear fruit and that your fruit would last. By the way, every man in this room wants to accomplish something that will last forever, because you've been created to do that. And that's why I've said if every man should fear to die until he has done something that will always live. And that is an important thing. And what will always live then is really the fruit that he's describing. So when you prune the vine and trim off some of the branches again, what you're doing is you're cutting it back so it'll bear more fruit. That's why I hate to watch Karen cut back her roses in the winter, because it looks like she just killed the darn thing. There's nothing but a little stump left. But the result the next year, as you see, it's got far more roses and far more fruitful than it was before. And of course, the cutting back is pain. It's adversity. It's a lot of setbacks we have. But that'll produce more fruit in the long run. Let me just make a few more comments, and then we'll close. But Christ in Colossians. I have a little book called Jesus in the Bible, and it looks at how Jesus is uniquely seen in each of the books of the Bible, in all 66 books. In Colossians, let me summarize how he is presented, so that next week when we start the book itself, we'll have this in our back of our minds. First of all, it's centered on what's called the cosmic Christ. He is the head of all principality and power. He is the head of all principality and power. He is the cosmic ruler over all things. He is also the Lord of all creation. So in chapter 2, verse 10, I'll give you the verses that correspond to this. It would be a good little study for you to meditate on these little verses. So the head of all principality and power, 2:10, the Lord of all creation, exquisite couplet of verses, 1:16 and 17. In chapter 1, verses 20 to 22, he's the author of reconciliation. He is the one who makes it possible for we who are alienated and estranged from God to be reconciled and to be made one with him in the unity of the Godhead. Though the scriptures always stress that in that unity, there's a plurality. You don't lose your identity. You don't become God. There is always the I, thou. You understand that's the difference. In the Eastern philosophy, there is no I, thou. In the Eastern philosophies, you get absorbed into the all, which isn't much of a relationship. He's the basis for your hope. He is the basis for your hope. Chapter 1, verse 5, verse 23, and verse 27. He is the basis. He is the foundation for your hope. In chapter 1, verse 11 and 29, it tells us he's the source of your power for a new life. You cannot live this new life. He is the source of the power. He is the dynamo. He is the one who animates the power. You cannot live this life apart from him living in you and through you. That's chapter 1, verse 11 and 29. He's also called the Redeemer and Reconciler in chapter 1, verse 14, and also in verses 20 to 22. And also another passage is chapter 2, verses 11 to 15. He's seen to be the Redeemer and the one who reconciles the world to God. He is also the embodiment of full deity, chapter 1, verse 15 and 19, and also chapter 2, verse 9. He is the embodiment of full deity. In him, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. He is also called the Creator, and he's the sustainer of all things. Chapter 1, verses 16 to 17. And he is the head of the church, chapter 1, verse 18. 1:18 also tells us he's the resurrected God-man. Chapter 3, verse 1 tells us the same thing. He's the resurrected God-man. And finally, he's the all-sufficient Savior. That is to say, in him, you don't need anything else. In him, you have been made complete. And there is nothing else that needs to be there. Verses for that, 1:28. Chapter 2, verse 3 and 10, and chapter 3, verses 1 to 14. My exercise for you, and I give this to a lot of people, is for you to meditate through, and I'd say suggest chapter 3, although the whole book is wonderful. Chapter 3, in our course of study together, is the one I'd like you to slowly, slowly work your way through. A verse a day would be enough, maybe two in the morning. That'll be enough. stop there. Read the verse. Read it again and again until you now have it in your short-term memory. Having it in your short-term memory, then you can close your eyes and you can meditate on that verse. And you can ask questions of it. This is something very few Christians do, but it's powerful. Having meditated on it, then you ask, God, what are you telling me in that verse? And you offer it back to God as a prayer. And having done that, then you stop doing the talking and start doing the listening and allow the Spirit to speak to you through the basic theme of that verse. You see where I'm going with that? That's a very excellent way of doing devotions. And if you do this way, this will take you the next few weeks to do it. By the way, in doing that, you'll find your life profoundly enriched because you're going to be forced to think God's thoughts after Him. And that is the way you renew your mind, because you know what it's like. This world is too much with us. And unless you're constantly trying to renew your mind and reviewing these things, it'll slip away. So you have to make the choice of showing up and reviewing these things and turning them over in your mind.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.